giving access, not granting it, right? This idea of letting people in. No, we're not gatekeepers. We don't let people in, right? We grant access and give access because they should have it. It should be a given. That should be the default, that people have access. So for me, growing up with a grandmother whose father was Black and white, but on the birth certificate could not acknowledge his real father because his real father was the owner of the land in which they, this is not a long time ago. You know what I mean? These are lived experiences. My husband, whose family has strong roots in the community that we live in, has had land taken from them. I think a lot of it is rooted in what will we leave behind? What legacy awaits us in the future? And what is it going to look like for our children and our children's children? So those are the things that kind of keep me up at night and wondering, will we leave this world better than we found it?
Hi, friends. Welcome back to Think Inclusive, real conversations about building schools where every learner belongs. I'm your host, Tim Villegas. Today's episode is about staying grounded in our values when the world feels complicated, especially around diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging. If you're an educator, you know these conversations show up in classrooms, in staff meetings, and in district decisions. Margot Gross helps us think about how we care for students, honor their lived experiences, and stay committed to what's right, even when things feel uncertain. Our guest today is Margot Gross, a national public speaker, educator, certified life coach, and Amazon best-selling author. Her work has taken her across the country and abroad, supporting schools and communities with clarity, humor, and a deep commitment to helping people be their best. She's also a former Teacher of the Year and a lifelong learner working toward advanced leadership studies at Harvard. We talk about what's giving educators hope right now, how to navigate divided spaces, and why belonging is more than just being allowed in the room. Margot brings honest stories about identity, family, and the everyday work of helping students feel seen and valued. And as a little side tidbit, Margot shares that she didn't see her natural hair texture until her 40s, and how that moment completely reframed how she thinks about identity and expression. Before we meet our guest, I want to tell you about our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by IXL. IXL is an all-in-one platform for K-12 that helps boost student achievement, empowers teachers, and tracks progress in one place. As students practice, IXL adapts to their individual needs so that every learner gets just right support and challenge. And each student gets a personalized learning plan to close gaps. Check it out at IXL.com/inclusive. Again, that's IXL.com/inclusive. All right, after a quick break, it's time to think inclusive with Margot Gross. Catch you on the other side.
My name is Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.
Margot Gross, welcome to the Think Inclusive podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Tim. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you on, and I'm excited about your background.
I'm glad you're excited. So I wanted to do during COVID, I wanted my background to be, you know, pretty for all of the meetings we were holding. And so I painted this wall. And of course, as soon as we went back to school, I regretted it.
Why? So, tell me why you regret it.
'Cause I mean,
so if you're listening, you can't see it, but if you're on YouTube, you can see it's like there's like triangular shapes in the background, and I see purple and pink and yellow and gray and blue and stuff like that.
Yes, there's even a silver one with a little bit of glitter here.
There you go. Okay.
Probably because I changed the decor in my room a lot. So there's like a base color, but like all of the accents always change. And my husband's like, okay, so now you have this wall, are you going to stick to it? And I have not.
Oh, man. Oh, man. Well, I like it. I like it. It's very colorful. I'm not, I'm like always in black or like, you know, dark colors. And then I have this black IKEA divider that I got months ago, but it works, you know.
It does. It looks really clean and polished. So.
Yeah, see, I've gotten so many compliments that I'm like, man, if they only knew it was like $30 at IKEA.
That is the best.
Exactly. Let's start talking about like what is giving you the most hope right now. So, like, what's giving you the most hope? And then what are kind of the things that are keeping you up at night or occupy, you know, space in your mind? And you can decide which one you wanted to go
for. All right. So I'll start with the what's occupying space in my mind and then shift to hope. And so I would say that right now what's keeping me up at night is sort of this concept of stewardship, right? That because of my faith, I just really believe that we have we're stewards over our lives. We're stewards over the world. And we've been given this awesome opportunity to make change and make a difference. And right now, I feel like with us sort of moving into this time period where we are trying to get rid of history, right? And the fear with that is that forgotten history often means repeated in the future, right? And so that concept has me up at night. I have children, so I'm completely invested in what happens after I'm gone. You know, I think we all are. And then looking at other children that I've taught, I feel like I take this work pretty personally because of how involved I am in DEI just by nature of who I am as a woman. And so I think a lot of it is rooted in what will we leave behind? What legacy awaits us in the future? And what is it going to look like for our children and our children's children? So those are the things that kind of keep me up at night and wondering, will we leave this world better than we found it? And I would say that what is bringing me hope right now is this belief that there is enough humanity left, right, to kind of save where we are right now as a society, the belief in people, right? So I still have people around me who are very humble, gracious, kind, who want to see everyone viewed in a very human lens and want all people to be well, thriving. And so I think being around humans who share that like mindset and philosophy is helpful in keeping me engaged in the process, because there are times with diversity, equity, and inclusion where indeed you begin to wonder, am I alone? And that would be my tad bit of advice too to people, is to try to get around other people who are making strides forward, and also connect with groups that are making a difference, so that you don't feel like there's nothing you can do, because there is a possibility of a hopelessness that you really have to fight and be intentional about battling during these times.
You mentioned your faith, a person of faith. I would say that I am also a person of faith, and I bring that up because I think in my life, various eras in my life, I found community and belonging in a faith community, right? And with having certain thoughts or values around diversity, equity, and inclusion, sometimes in faith communities, those values can be misaligned. It's not exclusively a church thing. Like, it could be your job, you know, it could be, you know, certain friend groups that you're with, like where you find these relationships and community, sometimes you're like, yeah, we are not tracking. We're not on the same page or whatever.
Yes, absolutely. And so
sometimes we have to change. We have to evolve and grow and maybe shift into a different community.
Can I just say something about that?
You go ahead.
That is one of the things that I think during this time period that has gone unspoken about, sort of. It's kind of not being said enough that during this time when there's so many opinions, right? Everybody has an opinion. Everybody's posting an opinion. And so you're sort of finding out about people's opinions on the fly, right? So it's almost like something has provoked or poked that person to now share that opinion. And so it is possible that you have known someone your whole life and you're finding out an opinion that never needed to be spoken. You know, maybe we just agreed that, you know, we wouldn't talk about politics, religion, you know, the top things that we don't want to talk about. And yeah. Maybe you've built these relationships. And what I found, Tim, is that there is a grief to realizing that someone you might have believed you had a strong connection with does not agree fundamentally with even your human rights, perhaps. Mm-hmm. That is a hard place. And what I'm so grateful that I'm able to label it as grief, because there are parts of it that make you angry. You're sad. Sometimes you even go into denial. It's the same stages as grief. And, you know, I kind of came to that as I was helping someone with grief. And I realized, wow, I'm having my own struggles with grieving relationships and people that I used to be connected to. And now there's this great divide, right? And as much as I try to find myself on the humble end of having courageous conversations and talking through everything, not everybody is in a rational space to do that.
Right? So true. And sometimes you're going to have to, you know, make a change, right? Make a change into whether that is your job, whether that is your faith community. We recently have engaged with a new faith community that shares the same values, specifically around diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so that was such a relief for me and for our family. It's been really beautiful. And you know, this idea of belonging, like we so desire. I mean, I'll speak for myself. I so want to belong, right? I so want to belong with people making a difference and having the same values. You know, being inclusionist, right? Like that's like an identity, right? So, I think it's just really important for us to acknowledge that we as humans need that. And if you're not feeling that way, maybe to examine, right? Examine what parts of your life you're not experiencing belonging. Because I really, you know, that's, it's so important to being a human.
It really is. And it shifts you from a person who feels tolerated to being appreciated, right? Because it's one thing to be in environments where you're tolerated. People will listen to your opinion on it. They'll deal with you, you know, but won't necessarily value what you bring and what, you know, your opinions, your background, your lived experience. And that's so critical to the core of who you are. And I think some people believe that there can be a separation, and at your core, you cannot separate, you know, sort of from who you are and how connected to diversity, equity, and inclusion that can be. I always say the belonging is sort of like the foundation to diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? It all rests on this idea that we get to take up space, right? We get to walk into rooms and take up as much space. You know, when I was little, people used to say I was extra. Now I get paid to be extra, right? I'm always doing professional learnings where I, you know, I get to dress up or do something crazy. I get paid to kind of be extra. But, you know, I used to apologize essentially for my culture, even code switching, changing my hair before interviews. So, you know, to some people, those things might seem silly, but in a sense, I was pushing down or pulling back core pieces of who I was and what I liked about me in order to fit into a community. But once you get to a place where if the room doesn't make you feel like you belong, you elevate yourself to the point where even when in spaces like that, right? Because it's not always promised that we will feel that way, but we certainly can believe in and of ourselves that we deserve to be here. We have the right to be here. And we have the right to our opinions, lived experiences, and cultural values. And it's taken me a long time to get there. I was, and I hope I'm not taking this too far off of the subject, but please. I was 40 something years old when I saw my real hair texture for the first time. I had been getting relaxers since I was 3 years old. So I discovered, of course, you don't remember what your hair is like at three. So I discovered what my real hair looked like at 40 something years.
That is wild.
Mm-hmm.
So do you mind if we unpack that for a little bit?
Absolutely, please. That's why I brought it up.
After the break, Margot and I get into what belonging really looks like in practice, how identity, culture, and lived experience shape the way students show up in our classrooms, and why honoring those pieces matters for every learner. We also talk about the courage it takes for educators who rethink old patterns and create space where kids feel fully seen. But first, a word from our sponsor. This episode is sponsored by Adaptiverse. If you're a special education teacher, you already know the time problem. Every week, educators spend 15 to 20 hours manually adapting curriculum for students with complex communication needs, non-speaking learners, AAC users, and students with apraxia or language-based disabilities. Creating personalized materials, building visual supports, and designing multiple expressive pathways is essential work, but it's exhausting and it pulls teachers away from actually teaching. Adaptiverse changes that. Teachers simply describe what they're teaching and who they're teaching, and the platform generates grade level lessons personalized to each student with built-in scaffolds and multiple ways to show understanding. And these aren't watered-down worksheets. They're rigorous, engaging lessons that presume competence. Built on 60-plus years of combined education experience, Adaptiverse has already powered more than 2,000 lessons in 35 states, with educators calling it life-saving and irreplaceable. If you're ready to get those hours back and focus on what matters most, visit AdaptiverseApp.com to learn more. That's AdaptiverseApp.com.
Look at that. You're just throwing me softballs. Tell me more about that, because you said you did not realize or did not see that as your natural hair texture. So why did it take so long, and what was the thing that prompted that, you know, change?
So, growing up, right? So clearly I identify as an African-American woman, right? Black. But clearly my skin is lighter. So there's a little bit of evidence that somebody along the way was not black, right? And so my grandmother is very, very fair skinned. And back in her days, she would have been able to pass, right? Which was an expression used to mean that a black person could kind of have the lived experience of a white person because of the color of their skin. And so it was very important to her that her children and grandchildren passed, right? And so I never thought I could for some other features, but she seemed to be embracing that view. And so growing up, it was always straighten your hair, you know, a blend. There was very much this message of blending, not standing out. And so as I got older and I began to get braids and do different things and cut my hair short, there was always this tension in my family between the sides, if you will, you know, my father's side that was much more rooted in history and much more proud of being what race they were, where my grandmother's side was kind of more, you know, and I won't say the whole side, but my grandmother definitely had some issues she hadn't ironed out. And so I think I just, because it seemed to be the sought after thing, you know, the straighter it was, the better. And there's expressions like good hair, bad hair, you know, all of that you grow up hearing, you kind of shift to this thought that it's not even, your hair's not even done unless it's straightened, right? And so it had been all I knew. My mom's a hairdresser, has been a hairdresser for 40 something years. So, you know, she'll tell you that I was crying, she was crying, trying to comb it. And she was like, let's just relax it and be done with it. But I think over time, I didn't even consider that there was another way until there was a huge movement of Black women saying, we're going to, you know, wear our coils. We're going to wear our hair curly. We're going to wear afros. We're going to be natural. And the craziest thing was my daughter did it first, right? Mm. And so sometimes we perpetuate unknowingly on our children. My daughters both had perms because I did, you know. And when she decided I don't want to do that anymore, I was like, okay. You know, I was in full support of her, but admitted that as a mom, I don't know what to do because I never did it with mine. And so it was interesting how she, every time I would get ready to perm my hair, she would be like, mom, you should just let it go. You should just let it go. And it just so happened that, you know, I won't go too far into it, but I got braids. When I took them out, my hair kind of was damaged. So I was like, let's do it now. Let's just cut it all off. And it really was a split second decision. It wasn't like I was thinking about it for a month. It was in that moment. I was like, let's just cut it. And so I cut it all off so that I could, you know, get rid of all of the chemicals. And we've been through a lot of variations of our natural hair in color and cut, but I am appreciating it now and learning much more about it. And it's fun to share with my child the many ways in which we can be creative with our coils.
Oh, that is great. I'm so glad that that is, you know, that is bringing you joy, you know, that you're, you know, finding that. I don't really have like a story to relate to the hair, but I do, you know, my family is from Mexico. Both my parents are from, my dad is from Mexico. My mom was born in Los Angeles, but, both sets of my grandparents are from Mexico. And, I grew up in very white spaces. Mm-hmm. Because I went to private school. I went to a Christian private school, and not that there weren't like other brown people, you know, or like Hispanic people, but I always felt white. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't like saying that, but that's definitely my experience. And I think it's taken me, you know, this long, well into my 40s, to acknowledge that and to like be like, you know, that is my experience, right? Like, there's nothing I can do about that. But also to like lean into a culture and a heritage that is not super familiar, but is still mine. And so like we're filming, taping this at the end of October. It's right around Halloween, November 1st, Day of the Dead. And so something that my wife and I, and this to my wife's credit, she's like, you know, really into this. We have an ofrenda that we have been using over the last 4, 5, 6 years. So we pull it out and, you know, we decorate it with like, you know, flowers and old pictures of family members that have passed and even pets and stuff like that. And, it's a tradition, you know, it's a Mexican, tradition. But just, I don't know, it makes me feel really good, you know, like, and, you know, you can get into all the spiritual side of it, but, like for us to be connected to that and to show that to our kids and, for them to feel connected to our, past and culture. It's just, it's great. It's wonderful.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, I guess, whoever's listening, it's like, it's never too late, right? It's never too late to do that. You could be.
You get to embrace at your own pace.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. Yes. So speaking of embracing, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and particularly those words, right? The words, people a lot, especially now, they just get really bent out of shape about those particular words. Mm-hmm. And especially like when you lump them together, like DEI, right? So we have this administration, we have the Trump administration, and we're barely even a year into this administration, and right out of the gate, he starts doing these executive orders and anti-DEI, this and that, and trying to get certain things out of schools and erasing history and stuff like that. So as a person who lives this, work, how do we navigate talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion? Maybe without using those words, or maybe do we use those words anyways? So what are your thoughts about that?
I think it's a little bit of both, right? You have to always know your audience. And certainly there are opportunities that I have to share where I'm not at liberty to use those words. And I govern myself accordingly. But you can describe a word without using it, right? So it does take a bit of a skill set there at times to figure out another word for things. But oftentimes when I talk about diversity, for example, I talk about difference, right? Whatever that difference may be. I'm often frustrated because I think one of the only areas of diversity we seem to talk about is race. And there's so many areas of diversity, right? And so I tend to talk about difference and the value that difference brings. I'm a person that loves to do metaphors, right, to bring about a point. So oftentimes I talk about trying to achieve something as a team, where everyone on your team might be a North or a South, or everyone on your team might have the strength of an achiever, whatever metrics you want to use, and how difficult it becomes when we're all the same. That diversity in perspectives and in lived experiences really does help us do our work better. Every bit of research I've read on it, it's always a helpful tool to garner additional perspectives. And certainly in the field of education, right, we have a diverse student audience who benefits greatly from diverse staff, right? But there's also this underlying message that if we're diverse, if we're inclusive, if we are talking about equity, that we in some way are saying that one group is not qualified, and we are giving way to this sort of, we want to hire people who are diverse over people who are qualified, as if they're mutually exclusive, right? As if to be diverse means you can't be highly qualified. And in a lot of situations, in different environments that I've been in, to be diverse actually meant you were overqualified. But that's just far beyond some people's mindset to even consider. And so I think when we get at the root of what diversity specifically means, is that various perspective that different people bring to the table, whether it's because they're from out of your district or out of your state, or speak multiple languages, or have traveled the world, or in some cases have a disability that has given them an ability to connect with a certain student population, right? I will also say this, and I haven't done any research on this, but if I ever finish my dissertation, it'll be around this issue, that sometimes what we say is, diversity really is a skill set, right? Sometimes we label something diversity because it's different, but what we don't understand is that there's a skill set from having lived in 16 different places. There's a flexibility you may have gathered, or multiple strategies from different places. And sometimes we just label it diversity, which doesn't give it its full scope of what, that could be. I remember a school being very upset that I had been moved to a different school when I was working there. And the school cited, my connection with the community and some other things. And that was kind of believed to be, a push to have me stay at the school because there were other Black children there who needed to see Black people in leadership, so to speak. And I remember the person that questioned me about it thought, well, don't all kids need to see Black people in leadership? And I was like, yes. But I think what they were actually describing was a skill set to speak a language that connected to families that maybe other people didn't have the language for, because culture also has a language, right? And it has lived experiences that you can connect to. I can say a phrase or use a certain group of words together that for a certain student makes them go, oh, okay, you know, she's talking to me, you know, which you could view as diversity, but I would say there's also room to view it as a skill set. When it comes to inclusion, right, I often talk about access, right? So I kind of shift to this word of, you know, giving access, not granting it, right? So there's this thought that I let you, and I think you and I have talked about this before at a MCIE, you know, Summer Institute, but this idea of letting people in. No, we're not gatekeepers. We don't let people in, right? We grant access and give access because they should have it. It should be a given. That should be the default, that people have access. And so a lot of times with inclusion, I talk about access. With equity, I do a lot of explaining that this is not about giving somebody a leg up. This is about not removing the rung on the ladder when they're on their way, right? Because sometimes that's exactly what's happening. Every time a certain population of students begins to close the gap or makes headway, we remove the ladder that was supporting the headway. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot of now. No one wants to get ahead in an unfair way, right? No one wants a leg up, if you will, in that way. But if I can't reach the rung on the ladder and someone supports me to get there, is that really overly accommodating, or is that just giving someone what they need, right? And so I like to define equity as giving people what they need when they need it consistently, right? And urgently, because sometimes we'll give people what they need, but there's this delay, right? It takes us a year to give them what they need. No, give them what they need consistently and then urgently.
They have to prove that they need it over and over and over and over and over again. Oh, man. I love that. I love that. I really like how you describe diversity, because you're right. It is totally like immediately you go to race, right? Mm-hmm. And even, you know, in my thinking, ability, disability, that type of thing. But what you mentioned is like personality or character traits, right? And that is really interesting. You mentioned North and South, and I'm not sure our audience will know that reference, but very, very broadly speaking, and I don't remember the name of it, but there's like certain personality tests you can take, and you know, you can decide if you're like a certain type of worker or thinker or whatever. And so I think that's what you're referring to, like North and South. And there's other ones, you know, Myers-Briggs, there's the Enneagram, you know, there's all these different ones that you can look into. But I'm just thinking about like the relationships that I have with people, right? And how like some of my really good friends, they're not just like me. You know, they're like actually quite different than I am. And we have different skill sets, we have different strengths. And, you know, my wife, we are very different, you know. But what makes us great is that we are different and that we have learned how to work together and do. So like that is, I think what you're talking about with diversity, like, I wonder if, like, wow, like, what if we could really just talk about diversity in that way, is that everyone has different strengths that they bring to the table. And that actually might mean that as a brown person, as a Mexican, you know, like Hispanic person, that is a strength, right? So race can be part of that, but it's not the whole picture.
Exactly. Exactly. I love how you put that. You know, there's been a lot of analogies or comparisons with, like, for example, you wouldn't say that a fish is not strong because it can't climb a mountain, right? A fish is made to swim, you know? And so I think in some ways we do that with ourselves when we want everyone to be the same and don't want diversity. We don't understand that in a sense, we're asking everyone to emulate each other. And I'm a person that just likes a little razzle dazzle with everything. And so I can't imagine living in a world where everybody thought the same. I actually love conversations when someone disagrees with me because I learned so much from it. You know, I too, as you noted, my husband's very different from me. He is a Black man as well, but he grew up in a rural town, very Southern. Everything is about family. Everyone moves as one. I grew up in the inner city, right? Very different lived experience. And so as much as you would think, you know, race would trump it and we would just get along so nicely in marriage, culture actually, you know, kind of trumps it for us. And in our relationship, we often see how our, the culture in which we were raised in plays a part in how we communicate with each other.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. How do you see this idea of disability justice fitting into like DEI and that thinking?
I don't believe we can talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion without talking about disability justice, right? Because, and not to sound cliche-ish, but it really is justice for all, right? That we need to ensure that a part of the conversation for equality, I prefer equity, right? That when we're talking about equity, when we're having that conversation, we're talking about everyone being able to get what they need. So when we talk about disability justice, we really do want to shine the light on that a student's disability should not be a barrier, right? We need to change what's around that student so that they can have, again, that access, that opportunity, right, that everyone else has. And to say that we want to educate them in the general education setting, right, which should be the norm, that should be the default for them. I think it goes further than that because once they're in the gen ed setting, we still have to make sure they belong, right? So as we talk about disability justice, letting me in a room isn't doing me a favor. It's actually where I'm supposed to be, right? But there's still this view that once the student is there, if they have a disability, I let them come to my class. So I've already done my part, but then we have them off to the side at a separate table. If they are working on something different, we make it very obvious it's different, right? Even in times where just the communication with non-disabled peers would be beneficial to them, we remove that justice component, and we insert our own values and opinions onto what that child's school experience should be like. And so when we talk about disability justice, for me, I see it as something that runs parallel. Now, the thing that I do cautiously walk in when I talk about equity and disability justice and even lumping together diversity, equity, and inclusion is that within those labels are people. Right. And so we have to be careful not to let the acronym DEI drown out the people that are behind that. So if we're talking about inclusion, whether it's because we want to include students with disabilities or we want to include those who come from different races or we want to include the LGBTQIA plus community, whatever that is, right? Those are people. So sometimes I think we get lost in like the acronyms and the titles and we forget that it represents people. And so even with disability justice or diversity, equity, and inclusion, you really want to highlight the uniqueness of the people we are talking about within that umbrella, right? Because it really covers the gamut, right? And so when I hear disability justice, I want to drill down into which disabilities and what do those people say? You know, I recently bought a t-shirt, Tim, that says nothing about us without us, right? And so I don't want to ever get on a podcast or anything and speak on behalf of groups of people in which I'm not a member, right? And yeah, I have idea what their thoughts and ideas are. And I only say that because when you're talking about something as vast as an umbrella as DEI, I want to make sure I'm showing some level of value for those that those terms represent, right? I remember someone telling me that the removal of DEI shouldn't be personal for me. And I'm like, what? Literally, I'm under that umbrella. Like, I am a couple of those initials, you know. And so, you know, I just think that, you know, disability justice can be broken down even bigger into our students with significant cognitive disabilities. What does it mean for justice for them? To me, that means that we are talking about presuming competence, right? That we aren't just assuming what kids can do and cannot do, but we are really presuming competence and believing that all students can grow, right? And we are providing supports and scaffolds to ensure that that happens, at least in that educational setting. And if we go on to talk about whether it's a student with autism, right, figuring out what it is that they need and how do they want to be taught, and not assuming that because a student has a disability that their voice doesn't matter, or not, how do I say this, not giving all of their education to an instructional assistant to do, so that now the teacher isn't even having a conversation with them anymore, you know, where the conversation is between them and an adult all the time. And if it is an adult, it's the one assigned to them and not the other students in the class. That's not an equitable voice. And so we're not giving justice to that. And so as I think about all the different things that this entails, I would say that part of giving justice to it is really looking at the individual students that this represents and really asking them the question, what does it mean for you to feel liberated and free in the spaces you're in school?
I want to get specific with you about DEI and what it may mean to some people. I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine, and he is in HR, and you know, in a large organization. I'm not going to say what it is, but he was talking about DEI and his experience with it, and he told me a story of how when, you know, certain positions are opened up, you know, in an organization, that the conversations around who will get that role or who will have the opportunity to get that role, people would say to him, like, well, you would be great for that role, or, you know, so and so would be great for that role, but we got to offer it to the, you know, we got to offer it to the other person, you know, of color, or we got to, you know, first. And I was like, that doesn't seem like what DEI is supposed to do. Like, what you're describing to me as DEI practices, I'm pretty sure isn't DEI. But like, so I tell you,
well, like any, Tim, I would say this, like any good thing, when done wrong, it leads to mixed perceptions, right? So I think about inclusion, right? And I laugh because people will say, oh, this inclusion thing, it's not working. And then when I say, well, what supports are in place for the students? None. I'm like, then that's not inclusion.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
So when you talk about DEI, right? That's not the way it should be done. Now, will I say people are doing it that way? Maybe, you know, but
yeah,
that is not what essentially that means, right? So when I think about it from an HR perspective, right, some of the things that I think about fundamentally for DEI is not allowing cultural biases, race biases to get in the way of the hiring process. Meaning, if someone comes in and they have this afro that I'm kind of wearing today, right, will you mark them down because to you, they're not well maintained? And so she didn't do her hair, you know, or silly things that get in the way of that hiring process, right? So it's really the removal of biases for the interviewers that don't, that will not provide barriers to people for silly things that have nothing to do with their ability to do the job, right? And so essentially that's a piece of it. From an HR standpoint, it also has something to do with recruiting, right? So if the only places you go to recruit are those of a particular race or ability, then you're limiting the pool of people that could perhaps apply for that job. And so to me, it's more about making sure we are recruiting for diversity, making sure we're not allowing biases and things to get in the way of hiring the best people when the best person may be a person of color, may be Black or brown, may have a disability, and the things we are using to discredit what they could bring are trivial and silly and can be supported for them to do the job, right? So that's the way that I see it. I also do, however, see a need for our children to have windows, mirrors, and doors, right? Sliding doors. So I don't know if you've heard that expression before. It comes out of culturally responsive instruction. And what it means is they need to be able to look out of a window and see someone else's experience, right? And so we should all not just come in with our own culture, our own way of thinking, but be able to see someone else's. We should have mirrors where we see our own, right? And then we should have sliding glass doors where we have these immersive experiences where we're literally getting into to that. And I only bring that up by way of saying there are times where I do believe our students need to see people who look like them, and there's value to that. But that does not mean that the trade-off is hiring someone who is not qualified for the sake of them saying, because think about what you're then saying. You would then be saying that I want the children to see an unqualified person of color. That does not help our movement at all. Like, that doesn't help us at all to hire someone unqualified. Like, that doesn't even make sense, because then it's more work on everybody else. And that does not serve a purpose. But what I will say, that's sort of a hidden thing that kind of, I'm going to go off on a branch here, is that there's also a lot of pressure as a person that belongs to the Black community to leave the door open. And what I use that expression to mean, when I get a job, I almost have to overperform, because I'm worried about what my performance might mean for the next person who applies, right? That because of, did I take off because I was sick? Can I take off when I'm sick? Or will that look like I'm lazy, right? Well, and there's a pressure that goes with the other side of that to ensure that I'm leaving the door open and I'm leaving a lasting impression that makes it easy for the next the next person to get in the door. And I don't think we talk about that enough either.
That's a great point. I'm having a flashback to a conversation, or any conversations I've had with my dad, because he's an immigrant. He came to the United States when he was young, you know, like 10 or 11, was, you know, a Spanish speaker, learned English and all that stuff. But he would say one of the reasons why he drove himself to be so good at his job, right? Is so that no one could, like, there would be no excuse to fire him. You know, like, he just wanted to be so good that being Mexican, like, uh-huh, wasn't the thing, uh-huh, that they're like, yeah, no thanks, you know? And so that was, and he would tell me that all the time. And uh-huh, I was like, that tracks.
I was raised to believe that you had to do double what everybody else is doing, you know, in order to at least even be seen as competent, right? You have to always do. And I think the only time that becomes problematic, well, I shouldn't say the only time, one of the ways in which that becomes problematic, right, is the messaging that your brain sends when it's time to do an assignment that you have all of this extra pressure, right? It's almost like a tax. You have this extra tax you have to pay to do a basic PowerPoint that other people don't have to pay, because they're not worried about whether they'll represent a whole race. They're just worried about getting their assignment done, because no one's going to say, oh, look at you letting your whole people down, you know, all your people down, you know, whereas often with Black and brown people, we do carry the weight of an entire race. So when we let something down, we become sort of a checklist for the stereotype that people want to have, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man, that's some good stuff right there. I hope that resonates with someone listening. So, good stuff. So let me ask you, as we're wrapping up here, where do you find, like, good information, especially around DEI, you know, because we just talked about it's misunderstood. Like inclusion, we know, is misunderstood. I say inclusion, they think a classroom or, you know, like a place or whatever. As far as DEI, where are some really good trusted places to get information about DEI?
So one of my favorites is NYU Steinhardt. They have a center, it's called the Metropolitan Center for Research on Equity and Transformation of Schools. And so I've made a connection with them. They did some work with me before, and so I've connected with them. They have a plethora of research around disproportionality in schools. So if people are looking for those kind of things, that is going to be excellent. I also find that nonprofits are probably one of my favorite because, again, they're not in it for greed. You know, it's not, you know, nobody's paying them to say what they're saying. So I try to do that. I think I'm going to say this one more time. Immersive experiences, anytime you can go somewhere and be a part of the group, right? Or ask that group, can you be a part of it? I think you find out much more. And I personally believe that that's one of the things that allows some of the, and for lack of a better word, I'm going to just call it foolishness. A lot of the foolishness we see going on today is a lot of it is because people don't have relationships with people outside of themselves. You know, everybody is like them. But those immersive experiences, Tash, who I know you're familiar with, I get a lot from them. The Autistic Self-Advocacy Network is another one.
Yep.
I do a lot with, and although Harvard has had to back off of some of its work, the Harvard School for Education has a lot. We have some local people in my area. One of them is the Southern Maryland Equity and History Coalition. They do a lot of history for my specific region and area. So I would say to people, wherever you live, look for people who are sort of grafting the history and talking about the things that have happened in your particular area, because there are some nuances that, you know, I feel like you learn about the place where you live, right? Which is huge. Of course, journal articles, research papers, Learning for Justice, formerly known as Teaching Tolerance, has a lot for educators around diversity, equity, and inclusion. I like to say they have not backed down. You know, they have continued to do things. Catch a Fire has a lot of DEI nonprofits listed that you can get things from. I follow the work of Gloria Latson Billings and Zaretta Hammond. Like, those are two of my personal favorites. And through NYU Steinhardt, which I just talked about, I was able to meet Gloria Latson Billings, which was a highlight of my career. And nice. I've also met Lisa Delpit, who has an interesting spin on some of the culturally responsive instruction components. I think she wrote the book Other People's Children. I hope I'm crediting her right for that. So I think those are some of the places that I go that I found to have the information that I need. I kind of look for information that operationalizes equity, diversity, and inclusion, because I find that sometimes it lives in this cloudy space, sort of in the cloud, and people are like, well, what do I now do with it? And so people like Zaretta Hammond have, you know, she has a book called Culturally Responsive Teaching and the Brain. And again, culture crosses a lot of things. I mean, there's skateboard culture, there's you know, there's a culture within everything we do. And so reading her book connects it to the neuroscience that's behind it, which is really good. And within that, she talks about the Ready for Rigor framework, which talks about how we get kids to this independent place, or how we get learners to this independent place to be ready for rigor. She also has academic mindsets, which are things like we need to facilitate for children. The thought that this learning has value to me, I can grow and learn with instruction. I belong to this academic environment, those kinds of things. So facilitating those in students. So those are some of the resources I lean on. And of course, Dr. Eric Carter's Belonging Will, because also he works a lot with faith-based communities. And so a lot of his work around belonging sort of is the base of a lot of my work. I'm now reading this book by Ken Williams called Ruthless Equity, which is really, really good. I'm not done, but so far I found a lot of his things, a lot of his ideas really support sort of the instructional components and really operationalize the work of diversity, equity, and inclusion in a school setting.
Those are fantastic resources. Really appreciate you.
No worries.
Sharing those. So lots to choose from. One more question before we get to the mystery question. So earlier in our conversation, you said someone said to you that you shouldn't take like DEI so personally or something like that. Is that?
Yes.
Yeah. So why do you take it personally?
So history and context, I think, matters, right? I think the people who say, you know, get over slavery, why are we still talking about that? That can be problematic in and of itself.
Oh my gosh.
but I also think that sometimes when people don't understand how connected family-wise these stories are. So for me, growing up with a grandmother whose father was Black and white, but on the birth certificate could not acknowledge his real father because his real father was the owner of the land in which this is not a long time ago. You know what I mean? Right. These are lived experiences. My husband, whose family has strong roots in the community that we live in, has had land taken from them. So for me, it's a deeply personal thing. One, because I feel like I was one of those people that were born with this fairness and justice gene that won't let it rest if I see something that's unfair. But two, because I just can't fathom going back. Like, I just can't. And there is a future that I have tried to even draw and paint for myself where we value each other as human beings. And that is without thought for necessarily having the same opinion, but really believing that there is value in your life, like that you get to live. And so there's that. And as I noted before, it's deeply personal for me because I have two Black girls who are now moving through the world. They have questions. There's a lot they don't understand. And it sickens me to think that my grandchildren, your grandchildren, right? Everyone's children and grandkids will not grow up in the world that I had a glimpse of. Not that we were ever arrived, right? Not that we ever arrived at this magical place, but I think we started to see glimpses of what it would mean if we would work together towards a common goal, or at least work together to understand that we all want what's best for our children and the outcomes for the future. I think everybody loves their kids, right? All of us do. They're a trip. They get on my nerves, but I do. I do love them, right? And so I just would love to leave behind a world that is better. And there was for a minute, at least for me, a glimpse of hope seeing the next generation embrace ideas that my grandmother's generation could never even fathom talking about, like even taboo things they were willing to have rich discussions about. And I saw us going in that direction. And then now with the needle kind of moving backwards, I just don't want to go back. Like, I just believe that there is a future we haven't seen yet. And I believe in humanity enough to believe that we can get there. And I know enough good people that I just hold to this thought that love, right? If we learn to love each other and pull together, that there is strength in that. And so for me, it's deeply personal because people show me these things so that I could make it out. I don't know if you know, Tim, but I am the product of two parents who were addicts. I could not read until late, you know, was put through the special education process, found to not be eligible, but put through it, you know, kind of labeled as, you know, of course, a problem. I came to school dirty. You know, when you're not being cared for, there's all of those things. And there was an educator who rooted for me. Miss Wilhelmina Harris at Simon Elementary School in Southeast DC taught me how to read and would not let me fail in spite of my home life. And so I had someone who pushed me, right? Who wanted what was best for me, who looked past all of the things that we now would label kids and kind of opt out. Well, what do you want me to do? You know, she didn't do that. And so I can't do that. And we can't do that, right? We have to continue to push ahead, because I think it's irresponsible, reckless, and selfish to take advantage of an opportunity and not give it to the next person behind you. I just think that's wrong. Like, so we got to grow up in this world where we have freedoms and we had, you know, but we're going to prevent it for someone else. I just can't stomach that for me. And I know that there are others like me who can't do that either. So I value that. And I hope that we will get together and prove that there is more good in the world than evil.
Margo, this is great. Question about, do you want to leave any links or anything that people can find you, Instagram or anything like that? Or do you just want to leave it? It's whatever you want.
I mean, they can follow me on social media. My pages are a mixture of personal, faith, and of course, diversity, equity, and inclusion. So if they're interested in all of my shenanigans and my sprinkles of extraness, then yes, they can follow me at Margo Gross on Facebook or Margo Medina Gross on Instagram.
All right.
We've covered so much already, from identity and belonging to what it really takes for educators to create spaces where every student feels seen. So to close things out on a lighter note, we're going to shift gears with a mystery question that gets personal.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. Mystery question. I've got two questions here. I'm mixing them up. I don't know which ones I'm going to pick. So,
oh, this is exciting.
Here we go. We'll start with this one. Here we go. Okay. What language have you always wanted to learn?
Oh, my goodness. Swahili.
Okay. So now you got to tell me why.
So I think it's beautiful. That's first and foremost. I definitely want to learn something that represents the continent of Africa, right? And so that would be important to me. I feel like when I was younger, I was a part of a group who, it was a peer drug counseling program. So we learned to be drug counselors for our peers, because during the 80s and 90s, there was a huge epidemic in the cities. And one of the things that happened is if you did a good job all of your years, you got to go to a country in Africa. And one of the young ladies came back and she was speaking Swahili, and I could not believe it. So
wow.
We learned a few songs in the language. Do not ask me to sing them, Tim. We learned a few songs back then. And I remember thinking, and I definitely learned a song in my choir in Swahili. And I always just thought it was a beautiful, beautiful language. And it represents beautiful people. So
absolutely, absolutely. Gosh, you know, this is going to sound pretty basic, but like, I've always wanted to learn Spanish because I don't speak it.
Well, you got a little extra pressure to speak Spanish.
Thank you for acknowledging
there's
that.
There's some pressure there.
Oh my gosh. You know what? I'm having this realization right now about like growing up in white spaces, because I think that just being vulnerable right now, like I think that I have what do you call it, not avoided, but like certainly like been wary of spaces where it's only Spanish speakers. Uh-huh. Because I can't understand or talk to anyone.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So that is a big barrier. That's a big barrier.
So my mother's sister is a Spanish teacher.
Okay.
And spent a lot of time in Panama and speaks Spanish as a second language. And she raised me. I was raised by my aunt. And of course, there's a thought that I'm supposed to speak it because she speaks it so fluently. I have nothing. And I went all the way up to the highest level of Spanish you can go. And all I remember was conjugating verbs and stuff. I don't remember.
Doesn't help.
Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I can do the basic greeting and things like that and count to 10 maybe, but that's about where it ends. Uh-huh. But yeah, you know, I feel like Spanish would be the most useful for me. I did go through a time where I learned sign language, and I would like to get back into that and sharpen my skills around that. Yeah. But Swahili definitely, and probably, Swahili. Yeah. Maybe French.
That's great.
It sounds so romantic.
Right. All right. So you get on Swahili and I'm going to get on Spanish, even though, you know, but listen, like we talked about before, you know, bring it full circle. It's never too late, right? It's never too late. Margot Gross, thank you so much for being on the Think Inclusive podcast. This was a lot of fun.
That was Margot Gross. What I'm taking away from this conversation is Margot's clarity about belonging, how it isn't something we hand out, but something we protect by clearing away the barriers that keep students from showing up as their full selves. Her stories about identity, community, and finding people who lift you up remind me that when we design systems where students don't have to shrink to fit, we move closer to schools where every learner knows they belong. One practical step for educators, help a student or colleague find a community where they feel supported and seen. Like Margot said, being around people who are moving forward can keep hope alive. And those connections are part of building inclusive systems. Share this episode with a colleague who's building inclusive schools. Rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Follow Think Inclusive wherever you get your podcasts. Shout out to Bad Bunny on his Grammy win for Album of the Year. David Tirar Mas Fotos has been playing nonstop this week in our house. We're getting ready for the Benito Bowl. Also, I heard there was a football game happening, so I guess we'll see who wins that. Do you have some music that you can't stop listening to? I'd love to hear about it. You can always email me at tvagus@mcie.org. All right, let's roll the credits. Think Inclusive is created by me, Tim Viegas. I write, edit, mix, and master the show. It's a proud production of the Maryland Coalition for Inclusive Education, scheduling and extra production help from Jill Wagoner. Original music by Miles Kredich with extra vibes from Melody. Big thanks to our sponsors, IXL and Adaptiverse. Visit IXL.com/inclusive and AdaptiverseApp.com. Fun fact, the Trump administration has officially dropped its attempt to use federal civil rights law to ban DEI or restrict how schools teach about race. The American Federation of Teachers challenged it and won, and with the appeal gone, the threat is off the table. Plus, Congress passed an education budget that keeps funding stable, including IDEA. I just want to thank Mrs. Frazzled, because honestly, that is where I get most of my education news these days. You can find her on Facebook and Instagram. And here's my question for you. How are you feeling about all of this news? Is it making you any more hopeful, or are y'all still living with existential dread? Email me at tvagus@mcie.org. I read every single message. If you want to support the show and MCIE's work, consider donating at mcie.org. Even $5, $10, or $20 helps us keep pushing for inclusive education everywhere. Find us on the socials almost everywhere at Think Inclusive. Thanks for hanging out. And remember, inclusion always works.
From MCIE.
Podcast rule. Welcome in.
My name is Mackenzie, and I started a GoFundMe for the adoptive mother of a nonverbal autistic child. The mother had lost her job because she wasn't able to find adequate care for this autistic child. So she really needed some help with living expenses, paying some back bills. So I launched a GoFundMe to help support them during this crisis. And we raised about $10,000 within just a couple of months. I think that the surprising thing was by telling a clear story and just like really being very clear about what we needed, we had some really generous donations from people who were really moved by the situation that this family was struggling with.
GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This podcast is supported by GoFundMe.